Do you think the government misunderstood the emotional zeitgeist around this whole prescription of Palestine action?
This is not a non-violent organisation.
When you have a prescription review group meeting, you have feed-in from the Department of Local Government who do a sort of community-type impact assessment. So that won't have been misunderstood.
Palestine Action was prescribed as a terror organisation in July.
A serious breach at Britain's largest Air Force base.
There is always the risk in the understanding of a sort of I am Spartacus aspect to this.
Apparently I'm a terrorist. It's news to me grandkids anyway.
I don't know whether they foresaw exactly this many arrests. I mean, there's clearly a coordinated campaign. I think it's by Defend Our Juries at the moment to try and bring forward people to try and make it look ridiculous.
Are you prepared to be arrested today?
Yes, I am.
Does it alarm you that that narrative's becoming a bit more popular, this idea that, you know, multiculturalism cannot work?
Yeah, you know? Yeah, it does. It does bother me. It does bother me. And I mean, because you know where it goes. China found a population of people called the Uyghurs, and there are Uyghur terrorists, but they said, let's have the whole population and let's get rid of them by putting them in camps, etc. That's where that goes. So of course I'd be worried about that.
What's left? We're back on The Political. Today, our guest is the government's leading terror lawyer, Jonathan Hall KC. Jonathan is the independent reviewer of terrorism legislation. Yeah, that's a mouthful. He's essentially in charge of looking at the effectiveness and the impact of the government's terror laws.
And national security laws.
And national security laws. Can you see where this conversation is going? Yes, we're going to be talking about all sorts of controversial stuff today, including the government's prescription of Palestine action, as well as concerns around democracy, subversion, generative AI, and all of that juicy, kind of scary stuff. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining on.
No, thanks for having me.
So, Jonathan, I mean, look, let's get straight into it. You were definitely involved, right, with this Palestine action prescription.
I don't know what that means to be involved. I mean, I sit in the room where it happens,
right?
Because I couldn't report on, but I sit there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll make a few comments in the meetings. It's called the prescription review group.
Is that
meeting.
In the Home Office?
In the Home Office.
Right.
But it, you know, involves people from all across government, but I'm not sort of formally involved in the decision making.
You're not telling the government what to do?
No, definitely not. I mean, I'm there often sniping from the sides,
right,
and asking, well, could you deal with it in this way? Could you deal with it in that way? I often put in quite sort of awkward, I throw in awkward points to see if I can sort of test a proposition, but I'm not a decision maker. But, you know, you could say I shouldn't be there, but if I wasn't there, how would I know how it works? So
what was your background in order to get into that position in the first place?
Well, I did loads of national security work as a barrister. I mean, I was sort of lucky. There was the, I mean, do you remember 7/7?
Mm.
There was the inquest into that. There was a junior barrister, she became pregnant, and a contact of mine said, would you like to become what they call developed vetted, which is the high security clearance, then you can work for MI5. And I represented MI5 as a junior barrister.
Right.
In the 7/7. And then after that, I just did lots of national security work. Not only, I did lots of other stuff as well, but I think I had the right sort of profile. I knew the territory. I'd done lots of terrorism stuff, criminal background, that actually helps quite a lot. And so I was approached, but I applied. There was a long process, sort of 7 or 8 months. And then I got the job.
So you've had years and years and years and years of experience looking at terror law. And I guess the big kind of way in for people now to discuss this issue is around that Palestine action prescription. Could you explain a little bit why the government chose that specific course of action to make Palestine action a terrorist organization, right? So if I said I support Palestine action, I would be arrested, no, by the government if we put that out?
Not exactly. We'll get into the details of the criminal offences.
Okay.
But the thing that people get arrested for is displaying an article. So
In
Northern Ireland, it's typically a flag of a prescribed organisation like the UDA.
Right.
And here it's that placard, isn't it, saying I oppose genocide, I support Palestine action. Interestingly, if you just say that, it's not the offence.
Oh, that's interesting, because Sally Rooney, didn't she just say that she couldn't come, or she's been advised not to come to the UK? But
yes.
I don't believe she's put up a placard. I think she just said...
Said it. If you can commit an offence of inviting support for a prescribed organisation, but then the prosecution would have to prove that you intended someone, or you were reckless that someone was going to start supporting the organisation. And I think what would probably be said in most cases, if you said, I support Palestine action, the prosecution might go, well, is there enough evidence? that that's what they're intending to do? Are they just perhaps saying, I oppose the prescription of it?
Right.
So if you like, there's a much more serious offence, which is based on speech, but the prosecution have to prove a lot more. And the sentence is up to 14 years. For the flag waving, placard waving, it's a 6-month maximum. And in practice, what people get is a, what's called a conditional discharge or a fine.
So that's the like 1,000 people or whatever who've been arrested so far, they're going to be getting fined then for what happened.
That's right, yeah.
Those are grandmas and
the grandmas and the priests and whatnot. People with, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's what they will almost certainly get. And, you know, it's not unique. So you get quite a lot of people who used to march in favour of the LTTE or the PKK. So Sri Lanka Turkey on the other. And so, you know, people would routinely go on marches, they would display a flag, which was a insignia of a prescribed organisation, and the police would deal with that by arresting them, and then they would go to court and they'd get a conditional discharge.
So on the Palestine Action prescription, what was the government's thinking? You were in the room, listening, in the room where it happens, not to quote Hamilton, but you know, you were there.
Yes.
So how do you explain the government's decision making?
Okay. I mean, I'm not going to tell you what happened because obviously I operate under a massive veil of confidentiality.
Yeah.
I came into the media and I said, then next time they're going to be...
What's left will be shut down.
No, not that. I'd be shut down.
Okay.
I think the thinking is, what you get the thinking is from what the Home Secretary said in this thing called an explanatory memorandum, which explains to Parliament why they're doing what they're doing and asking Parliament agreed. It's the scale of it. I think that's the real thing. It's the scale of it. It was an organisation that didn't just carry out one or two things, but it carried out some very serious things. So the thing that seems to have flipped the government was the spraying inside the jet engines of those jets of Bryce Norton. It wasn't just slogans on the outside. It was pumping stuff inside, which led to millions of pounds worth of damage. But there was also the attack on Elbit in Bristol, which is the matter that's going through the courts at the moment. But what is in the public domain is that involved taking quite serious weapons, so whips and a sledgehammer, during the course of it. And this is a matter that's going to be tried as to whether the person was responsible or who did it. But a police officer was very seriously injured with that. And there was, at the very least, you can say there was a degree of sort of reckless willingness to use violence against people as part of their determination to smash Elbit. So you've got that. And then what I would factor in is the website. Okay. The website had a manual you could download how to carry out a covert action as Palestine Action. Maybe that's one thing if it's just painting on bridges, but if it involves really serious violence to property, where in fact individuals may get hurt, you can see why that's a bit worrying. It also had a targeting list and it had a presence throughout the country and they had training days. I don't think that where you have that level, and I want to come on to the democracy thing, but where you have that level of organised damage to property of the millions of pounds, mm-hmm. plus with a willingness to use violence against people, I don't think the government could have let that carry on. I mean, the idea of people turning up to training days in Bristol or Newcastle or Brighton or whatever, training how to carry out covert attacks causing millions of pounds with the risk to people, because I think you've got to be honest about it. If I've got a valuable property, let's say I am an arms manufacturer, which is not a bad thing at the moment. We have to have arms, don't we, to help Ukraine.
Yeah.
If I'm an arms manufacturer, I'm probably going to have security guards. I'm probably going to have people working. Well, I will have people working there. And there'll probably be police all coming up as first responders when there's an attack. Those are all people. And I don't think you can ignore the risk to people when people are so determined. But it was the scale of it. And I think when I have this debate with people, and obviously some people disagree with it, they say, well, Jonathan, surely you just use normal criminal law. Yep, these guys have committed a crime. Just arrest them. The problem is the funding and the training. You can't just arrest someone because they've given a pound to Palestine Action. You can't just arrest someone because they're on a training day. What they need is the extra powers from terrorism legislation, which allows you to shut it down, basically. So what the Home Secretary said, and I sort of agree with her, the scale of what they were doing, the organisation of what they were doing and what they were willing to do meant that this was operationally the only thing that they could do. And I mean, I candidly think that if they hadn't done it, people would have been saying, what are you going to do about it? And one of the things you would end up having to do is the government would have to legislate, I suspect, urgently to bring in some sort of lesser measure, like, all right, they're not terrorists. Because, of course, I get the point, this is novel. And, of course, I get the point that they are not Islamic State. I mean, I, of course, one can see that, it, you know. But you'd have to bring in some other measure, like, based on extremism. And our the experience the UK's had is trying to work out what is an extremist is really difficult and gets you into territory where you actually go, I'm not comfortable with that. So my own sort
of... In terms of a free speech thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Right. I mean, Michael Gove tried to define it. And I mean, I remember, you know, having debates about this. Actually, if you looked at the definition of extremism, it included people who wanted to abolish the House of Lords.
Right.
Because you start talking
about... Which is now
about,
most...
Well, this is...
Most political parties.
Exactly, exactly.
Critics would look to history, and I think the most notable thing would be the suffragettes and kind of some of their methods that we used about 100 years ago in order to get the votes for women.
Yeah.
What correlations could you say, and are there any correlations? Is that a legitimate kind of thing to equate Palestine Action to? Where we kind of look to history to find some inspiration about how we kind of navigate a democracy that is increasingly
I think you put your finger on the actual pulse here. This is about democracy. So I would say suffragettes are completely different from Palestine Action because women did not have the vote. Women did not have a way of influencing what our politicians did in our name. Palestine Action absolutely do have the vote. And I think what I see from Palestine Action are people who've said, actually, we've tried protesting. It's not worked because we haven't persuaded voters to vote for parties who will, you know, break all ties with Israel. So let's move to the next stage, which is direct action. The suffragettes, like Nelson Mandela, they didn't have that ability to participate in democracy. So I think there's a very clear distinction.
The Guardian view, which I have a bit of sympathy for, is this idea that people's understanding of terrorism, you know, has some form of murderous intent involved, right? It's got something about killing people as part of it. And that's what terrorism is meant to guard against. It's meant to guard against people being physically harmed in pursuit of like a political aim, right? And I kind of get this view, like we live in this comms environment where people are just understanding politics through, you know, what clip they're seeing.
And what's then left.
When they see something like this. And you're seeing an 80-year-old woman, a pacifist, you know, getting arrested for protesting the fact that Israel is committing a genocide in Gaza. You know, this is something, when I said the fact that the UN had found this.
They must stand up for the people of Palestine and the fact that this organisation is a terrorist organisation, which is terrorist, and that we are losing our civil liberties.
And people are really concerned that our armed forces are participating, are, you know, providing arms, that Elbit Systems, which is an Israeli company, is based in the UK, is very much, you know, intertwined with our armed forces, that the RAF in Cyprus are conducting. I'm rattling off all of this. The optics of it look terrible,
well,
right?
On the free speech issue, I want to come to the optics. On the free speech issue... When the last government was first confronted by some of the pro-Gaza marches, there was thought, and there was, you know, it was public, that maybe you should just make any potential support of Hamas a strict liability offence. So if people who are saying from the river to the sea, well, that sort of picks up, resonates with Hamas, so maybe that should be a terrorism offence. And I mean, my view was, no, that's way too far. And you know, I wrote a paper. I don't know whether it was influential, but the government didn't go there. Good. On the question of whether you can protest, I mean, you have to treat me like a total idiot here and spell out in words of one syllable. I don't see how banning Palestine Action stops anyone protesting about Gaza. And I've yet to hear a good argument. I mean, I hear the word chilling, but obviously you don't say, I support an organisation, Palestine Action, in order to say whether you think Israel's committing a genocide.
Yeah, I mean, I said it all without having to say it. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that when it comes to the ridiculousness, the way in which I put it in, I wrote this comment in the comment piece in The Observer, is bearing in mind the people who are arrested, which includes some elderly people, quite a lot of elderly people, actually, they've deliberately chosen to say, I support the organisation. I think it'd be ridiculous if they weren't arrested, I mean, can you imagine saying, I support Hamas, I support Islamic State, and not being arrested? And I think that there's a real question about equality under the law here.
Yeah.
I mean, just because you're a dog-collared elderly cleric doesn't give you some free pass.
Right.
And in fact, that sort of immediately starts me sort of thinking, feeling a bit uneasy, actually. The idea that how you look should affect how you're treated by the police is, you know, the opposite of what we want in this country. So,
but it is how, unfortunately or fortunately, you know, people do engage with politics. And I think that there is a sense that, you know, that whole phrase, you know, everyone one day is going to be against this, you know, against what's happened in Gaza. That's the kind of prevailing thought.
Well, that reminds me of that sort of funny phrase, on the wrong side of history, which, again, I don't really understand how that's an argument. I mean, we could have an argument about what's happening now.
Right.
Rather than just sort of trying to predict what the future is going to say.
Yeah. And I guess I also just think that nonviolent civil disobedience, the type that was kind of used during the civil rights movement in America, for instance, the point of nonviolent civil disobedience was in some ways to entreat a clampdown from the government. It was seen as a legitimizing factor for the people who were doing those movements, right? Because then they would be able to say, well, look, we're pacifists. And the government's cracking down on us because we're trying to represent a specific political opinion. And I think that, you know, whilst there is, and I completely accept your points that there are some concerning organisational capacities involved in Palestine Action that can scale this massively, we should also arrest why there's a possibility to scale this to begin with, right? Like why there is so much popular consent or popular support for this organisation. And I think that, ironically, you could argue that this is playing into their hands.
Well, it's a bit like, I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about the United the Kingdom march.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of this funny, interesting parallel, isn't it? Because you've got the organiser was Tommy Robinson, who's obviously...
convicted fraudster.
A criminal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And with a fascist background.
Yeah, former member of the BNP.
He has inserted himself, isn't he, into actually quite a lot of legitimate expression. I mean, a lot of people on that march are in no way connected with...
are not far right.
Robinson, whatever. Obviously, they're connected because they went to the march, but they're not followers of them. And will have legitimate things they want to protest about immigration, about culture, etc. And there's something sort of similar here. Palestine Action, maybe it's quite a clever ruse. And I suppose, I mean, I remember someone saying to me, it's the name. I mean, it's really hard because Palestine Action has got the name Palestine in it. And they've inserted themselves in. But I think the reality, I mean, anyway, speaking as an evidential lawyer, I think that the march is organised by Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Mm. They have carried on. It hasn't stopped anyone protesting. If you want to, you can say, I support Palestine Solidarity Campaign. If you want to, you can say, I oppose the prescription of Palestine Action. All of that must be legitimate. Mm. So, I mean, it seems to me is you're completely right. They're trying to provoke a reaction. They're trying to make it look ridiculous. I, of course, acknowledge that this is different from Islamic State, but that's the nature of the game, isn't it? I think that is what's going to happen. You are going to have a sort of difficult piece of policing. But ultimately, I mean, my view is, if you are serious about stopping a proscribed organisation, you have got to cut down the, if you like, the auction of publicity.
Do you think the government misunderstood the emotional zeitgeist around this whole prescription of Palestine Action? Because it's such an emotional...
I mean, when you have a prescription review group meeting, you have feed-in from the Department of Local Government who do a sort of community-type impact assessment. So that won't have been misunderstood. There is always the risk and the understanding of a sort of I am Spartacus aspect to this. I don't know whether they foresaw exactly this many arrests. I mean, there's clearly a coordinated campaign. I think it's by Defend Our Juries at the moment to try and bring forward people to try and make it look ridiculous. I suppose it's not outside our historical knowledge of terrorism legislation. I mean, it's a traditional tactic by groups to try and provoke a reaction.
Mm.
And so quite frequently, you'll get some sort of, I mean, I'll use the more sort of dangerous end, you'll get an attack. And the very purpose of the attack is to bring a clamp down on a particular group, say a diaspora group, and then the group can say, and the IRA in a way did this during the 70s, they said, look, we provoked a reaction from the Brits, we're the only people who can protect you now, we the IRA. And so the IRA in the 1970s were able to say, we are effectively your protection to the entire nationalist community against the Brits by provoking the reaction. So I think it's a well-known tactic, and we'll have to see how it plays out.
I think that this idea about, you know, two-tier justice is really interesting, isn't it? It's a phrase that's brought up by the left. It's a phrase that's brought up by the right. When you see stuff, you know, you brought up the United Kingdom rally, Elon Musk gets beamed in to Tommy Robinson for them to have a one-to-one.
Right.
And this foreign billionaire is essentially encouraging people to overthrow the government.
Question here, whether you choose violence or not, violence is coming to you. You either fight back or you die. You either fight back or you die. And that's the truth.
That to me sounds like subversion, sounds like inciting terrorism. And then you see on the other side, let's say Southport, for instance. Southport, you have people inciting violence, you know, trying to burn down a migrant hotel for political reason. I mean, for me, like, as a layperson watching on, you're like, that's terrorism. And yet the way it was prosecuted was not through terror law. And then on the other side of the ledger, you have a direct action group, not, you know, directly attacking people. I mean, in one case, perhaps, but over 385 yeah. cases, not doing that. Then charged as terrorism, right? It feels to people who are sympathetic to these, you know, maybe on the left side, that these things aren't being prosecuted the same way.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've got a lot of sympathy with that view. I suppose going back to what we were talking about Palestine Action and then developing it, if my ultimate concern is trying to, one hopes that national security laws like terrorism protects democracy,
yeah.
so allows politicians to make free decisions about the view you take about Israel, the view you take about the arms industry, etc. There will be circumstances where you have these really awful, vile threats to MPs. I don't even remember, there was an incident last year where an MP stood up. There was a famous instance where a debate couldn't take place on Gaza, and I think Labour pulled the motion. Do you remember? It was an SNP
yes,
motion.
Yes.
And there was an MP who stood up and said, I need to be able to say publicly that I oppose Israel's actions in Gaza because I and my wife have been threatened with death. I mean, it was wow. a really striking incident of how threats can intrude. And I mean, I've always said, and I've said repeatedly and publicly, that sometimes threats to MPs in particular, and I would also include threats to judges, I would also include attacks on think tanks. There's been an attack recently on a think tank in London. These are really attacking, if you like, the organs of democracy, and that's where you may need to use those extra powers. Why did Lucy Connolly not get charged with terrorism?
She posted inflammatory messages on social media whilst riots took place across the UK this summer, following the Southport killings. Connolly tweeted hate-filled messages calling for mass deportations and violence against asylum seekers, which went viral and were viewed over 300,000 times.
Have you been Keir Starmer's political prisoner?
Absolutely.
I mean, there's no sort of hard and fast rule on this. They tend to go for hate crime, for racism, or stirring up racial hatred. The difficulty in a terrorism prosecution is proving that extra bit, that she wasn't just full of hate, but she was actually trying to advance a cause.
There's an ideological motive.
Exactly. So let's say you've got an organisation, going back to Palestine Action, with a sort of programme. Well, it's pretty clear that they are. When Lucy Connolly hit her keyboard at whatever time of night and said something which was, you know, not just awful, but murderous,
yeah.
it's hard to know. And the prosecution, I suspect, would have... Can we say that she's doing that to advance court?
But not even just Lucy Connolly, though. The people who actually were trying to burn down that hotel were
yeah.
not
yeah.
prosecuted as terrorists.
Yes.
But and surely there was a political underpinning to what they were doing.
And this is what I was going to say. I mean, to many communities for whom that would be deemed as a form of terror and could be read as terroristic, and then you get the labels of two-tier Keir and two-tier justice, it seems to fly in the face for the sentiments of many communities who are victims of the narratives that people like Lucy Connolly put forward, and then subsequently the actions of those protesters and those aggressors.
It's always a question of evidence. I mean, if you look at the number of, say, children who've been arrested, so 40 have been arrested in the last 12 months, I mean, it's a huge amount. Almost all of those are extreme right wing. So there is no difficulty in the police identifying people who hate Muslims, Jews, black people. I mean, there's a lot of prosecutions of people as terrorists. I think the reason they can do it in those cases is because they have manifestos.
Mm. Right. And the United Kingdom rally, Elon calling to overthrow the, I mean, surely
yeah,
that's
to overthrow the government.
I mean, how do you
I mean, it seems to be quite a long way from terrorism, actually. I didn't even think it was an offence. I mean, people are entitled, they've got to be entitled to call for the overthrow of the current system. People use words like battle, like martial language all the time. What he didn't do was say anything specific enough. So a prosecutor could say, yeah, this guy is actually saying to these people, go and commit some immediate act of violence now.
Right.
So, I mean, it was nowhere near. I've listened to the YouTubers, as I'm sure you have as well. I mean, you know, it's foreign interference, if you like, although it wouldn't qualify as foreign interference under our laws because he's a private citizen.
Right.
And, you know, I think we can have a genuine debate. Do you want to have people who are big and powerful have their voices heard? Because why not hear what big and powerful people say? Or do you want to say, just, you know, F off?
Yeah.
It's not your country. I mean, he seems to regard the UK as a bit of a sort of personal project,
which
is uncomfortable. But, you know, from a free speech perspective, I sort of think it's got to happen.
Right. The comms of this, right? I think this is a really interesting space because ostensibly the former Home Secretary, now the Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper, kind of struggled, I think, to get the public on side here about some of her decision making. I mean, why do you think that? I mean, one of the things that she was saying was that there's stuff that I know that you don't.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that that is an effective way of winning over popular consent at the moment, when people feel a level of distrust generally around the government, you know, from left to right,
these
two-tier accusations, etc.
There may be people who are objecting to prescription who don't know the full nature of this organisation because of court restrictions on reporting while serious prosecutions are underway. But it's really important that no one's in any doubt that this is not a non-violent organisation.
But she really struggled, I felt, to like communicate with the public about what procedures she was taking. Does that worry you that, you know, a Home Secretary who's getting, you know, has the ear of you and many others, and there's a lot of good evidence and good reasons for what they're doing, can't explain to the public why they're taking a specific course of action?
Yeah, it bothers me massively. Yeah, because I think that communications really, really matter. And, you know, public confidence in counterterrorism is really important. And I think it should bother all of us who are involved in counterterrorism that there are people who are thinking something's gone wrong with the prescription of Palestine action. So it's absolutely crucial. And I wish more could be done. I think we have to go back to Southport on this, and it's our contempt of court laws. I mean, as you probably remember, I was quite critical about the lack of information about the Southport attacker at the time, and that was a shadow of contempt of court.
Right. That's the information gap.
That's
just for
the
viewers.
Information, exactly. So contempt of court are the laws that stop people, particularly the media, from saying things that might prejudice a fair trial. Working out what's going to prejudice a fair trial is really difficult, because when the judges in the past have been asked to say, what does that actually mean? They sort of go, well, it depends. So it's really hard. Someone like the Home Secretary will be saying to herself, look, I believe very strongly in the constitutional separation of the powers. We're the executive. The criminal justice process has to be completely separate. She's not Jonathan Hall. She's not some commentator. She's the Home Secretary. So she'll be really mindful of saying something, and then defence counsel in the trial standing up and saying, well, judge, these individuals can't have a fair trial because the Home Secretary of the United Kingdom has said on media, which every juror is going to remember, that this thing happened and they're all terrorists. So it is a problem under our law at the moment. I mean, personally, I would like to see our law cut back quite a lot, so that people could say a lot more about trials that are about to happen, because I don't believe, actually, that judges can't deal with this risk. I mean, when you deal with a jury, you say to them, put everything out of your minds, and you trust them to do that. And they're not stupid. They read that, you know, they have friends and family who'll be very interested in what they're doing. They're given a direction not to discuss it with their friends and family, and they do that.
So you're essentially calling for more information from authority. So just to remind listeners, after Southport happened, there's loads of speculation around who the murderer was.
Yeah.
There was a fake conspiracy theory that it was a migrant from a small boat called Ali al-Shakati.
Yes.
And then it was later revealed that was Axel Rudabukana.
Yeah.
And then people were saying that he's a Muslim. And then other people are saying, well, he's actually from a Rwandan Christian background.
Correct.
And you had all of these conspiracy theories fill the gap.
Yeah.
Of a lack of information, right? So you're saying that the way to counter that is to then, for the authorities to literally be releasing, I guess, as they're getting it, accurate information about what's about the case.
Yeah, yeah, accurate information. I mean, there'll be circumstances where, I know, someone's on the run and the authorities don't want to say very much about it at all for operational reasons. There could be some circumstances where they just don't know. So, I mean, let's say...
Well, then they wouldn't want to say that, would they? Because that would undermine public trust.
Exactly. But in a case where you've had a terrible attack, the attack has been caught, people just... I mean, I remember I was on holiday in America. I suspect you were as well. I was on social media. Like, well, who is this guy? I want to know. Who is this guy who's gone and killed all these children? It's just a natural human reaction.
Yeah.
And I don't think we can leave that to social media. So we know, as a matter of fact, by the way, that it was because the Crown Prosecution Service said to the police, you cannot say, even the fact that he was a Christian, they were saying, you can't do that. So, I mean, that's come out in Parliament. So we know what the law is and why it's a problem. And we also know it's unsustainable, don't we? I mean, there's obviously, you all ask me rightly, so what if the police say it's this guy called Askarida Kabana, who's a black Rwandan Christian background, are they going to be believed? Now, there's obviously always going to be the possibility that some people are so deeply into the conspiracy theories, they're not going to believe it. But I think that most people, when they hear a sober police officer, the commander of SO15 or whatever, come out and say it, will go, okay, I've got it.
You were talking about the Home Secretary and the powers, but it seems as though there's a bit of a selectivity. Prior to becoming Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood was the Justice Secretary, and she was able to make more particular concentrations of her authority around immigration. So surely why could that not happen on other issues around terrorism and making that more accountable? She's reclaimed some of those powers back to Parliament, which I'm a huge supporter of. But it seems as though we need more. And why should that not be the case?
Well, it's just when you've got a criminal case. I mean, I don't think... Did Shabana Mahmood say anything particularly in advance of a criminal prosecution?
Oh, no. That's the specific issue,
yeah.
Interesting.
Mm. I mean, it's an interesting appointment. Have you met the new Home Sec?
Not yet, no.
But I imagine you'll be getting acquainted soon.
I'm sure I will.
You've worked with quite a few Home Secretaries now over the years.
Yes.
Is there, I mean, obviously I'm not going to get you into say anyone's name or anything, but do you ever have relationships that can be more tense than others or more challenging than others? Or are people, when it comes to matters of national security, actually just really, you know, country first, party second about their politics?
I think the latter, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, you know, I tend to do more with the security minister. So that's the one who, not the minister of state.
So that's Dan Jarvis
at the moment.
Yeah.
And I've met an awful lot of security ministers from both governments, Conservative and Labour. And that actually is the approach. I mean, it's
well, that's good to hear. And I think people in the public need to hear that actually, right? Because I think there is a sense that everything's politicised. But one of the main things that the government's responsibility is to do is to secure the security of the state, you know, for its citizens, right? And to make sure that people are safe from terror or from foreign actors, etc. But it does feel like right now, with an unstable world order, with the disorder that we see every day beamed into our phone screens, that the government actually doesn't have a handle on these things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I think as I said at that event, I used to think that comms was fluff, but now I think that comms is like
everything.
so important, because if you go back to what national security is, there's no definition of national security, but I think it's about people getting on with their lives and being able to work in a democracy where we vote for politicians and they decide and then we have an election every 4 years, but basically we get on with our lives and we'd have to worry about bombs and arson and subversion and Russian invasions and whatever. So I think that explains why when you have a really serious attack, and we haven't fortunately had any of those mass casualty attacks for quite some time now, for several years, that's why I think politicians come on and they say, we go on as a democracy, we go on members of the public, because that sort of communicating that we shouldn't panic is really, really important. The problem now, of course, is that we're looking at our phones the whole time. And what obviously sells eyeballs is stuff that sort of, you know, worrying, aggravating, you know, extreme stuff that gets our juices flowing, that we interact with, that we tweet on, all of that stuff. And it's quite hard, I think, first of all, to know as the ground truth how worried we should be. And I mean, I'll give you an example. We now know that a lot of stuff on the internet is just bots. And if you look at, let's say you or I were to put out something on, I assume you're on Twitter, I'm on Twitter as well. Let's say I put out something on Twitter. I could look at the number of retweets, okay? And I'll look at the comments and I'll say, oh my God, this tweet I've done, there's 10,000 people have retweeted it or have commented on it. And there's loads of haters there. and you sort of go, well, okay, well, the number is really high. You'll look at a few of the comments and you'll see some very extreme ones. Mm-hmm. Those really extreme ones could actually just be bots.
Yeah.
There could be lots of real people tweeting, but their interactions would be different. So I think it's genuinely really hard. And I haven't heard enough politicians sort of say this. We all believe, don't we? And I'm afraid I'm guilty of it as well. I sort of say, I think most people will do this. We don't really know, do we? And we know our friends and family. And if you're an MP, you'll know your interactions with constituents and things like that. But so much of what we think we know is based on the internet. And there was a very interesting paper that came out a couple of months ago about the Scottish independence referendum. And 250,000 pro-independence tweets were traced to Iran bots.
And then the Bunker Busted bombs happened and those accounts went down.
Yeah, exactly.
Those accounts went, that's insane.
It's insane, isn't it?
So just for clarity for listeners, America dropped bombs on an attack on Iran and accounts that were tweeting in favour of the SNP went down.
Correct.
So, and that's just Iran. Iran are meant to be the guys who are kind of shit at this, right? Like, they like, can't organise a piss up in a brewery sometimes, you know? They're the ones who are struggling.
I wouldn't underestimate them.
Really? Really? So, I mean, compared to, like, Russia or China?
Well, the big three that the government talks about, obviously rightly, is Russia, China and Iran. And they've all got different capabilities, but they're not insignificant. I mean, if you want to think about Iran, I go back to the fatwa against Salman Rushdie.
Of course.
And there's a very good book called Joseph Anton where he describes how worried the state was back in the 80s about Iran's ability. And he was being hidden in sort of SAS bases, covert houses, being moved all the time. Yeah. And you have a really vivid sense from that book, oh my God, the Brits knew that Iran was pretty capable. And we know they're capable because they've carried out a lot of attacks on British soil. Many have been foiled, but not all. Iran TV had to be moved to America. Do you remember this? Because of the high threat that was coming from Iran. An Austrian citizen was caught carrying out what they call hostile reconnaissance, videoing the premises where they were so that they could create attack plans. Iran are capable. And so going back to the point about division, it is difficult, isn't it? Because obviously we know that we've had Brexit, Trump 1, Trump 2, the Ukraine war, rise of China, Xi's aggression, over Taiwan. All of these things are objectively true. But we also have to know that there are people in whose interest it is to try and escalate that sense of tension in order to make us think, actually, we can't trust anything.
And I guess that was kind of what I was going to ask about in relation to your comments around subversion and a propensity for hostile actors to sow some form of discord in our own country around potential Scottish independence. Obviously, there's a rising issue around masculinity and incel Definitely. Culture and things of that sort. I guess you've spoken to it, but elaborating on it, is this a kind of political and legalistic kind of mainstream that we could be entering in? And how do we, from a legal perspective, how do we ensure a sense of resilience to all of that? Because we can talk about the political side of it, and we've kind of discussed at length some of those kind of things, but that has to be underpinned by a rigorous kind of legal infrastructure. Yeah. And it seems as though we have a bit of an outdated kind of way of doing things. Is it able to accommodate some of these challenges of the day?
Could you also explain for listeners what subversion is?
So subversion is someone who clandestinely undermines democracy. It's got a dirty name. Dirty name, is that the right word phrase? It's a bit of a dirty word because there was counter subversion in the 90s. Well, obviously in America, McCarthyism.
Yeah.
Was counter subversion and went too far
against communists,
Reds Under the Bed. In the UK in the 1970s, there was an elite group of undercover officers called the Special Demonstration Squad, who went in and spied on people who were
Mines.
Some would have been communists, some would have been sort of CND,
the enemy within,
etc. And they had relationships
with women.
Some of these women. Yeah. Who then, I don't think you can quite calculate how bad it was for the women, who then discovered that their partners, etc. Anyway, so that agenda went. But the point I was making in that speech is that we are now entering a slightly more subversive world because adversaries like Russia are absolutely trying to undermine our confidence in democracy. It may not be coming from the same people as it did in the 1970s, but it's certainly there. And of course, it's massively changed and amplified by the internet. So on what the law can do and this thing about resilience, I mean, the law has been updated. So you probably know a couple of days ago, there were two research. One was the chairman of the China...
Yes, research, whatever.
Research group.
Who was accused of being a spy.
He was accused of being a spy. And the prosecution have just announced that they dropped it. And the very strong hint that was given in the communications was it was because they couldn't prove evidentially that China was an enemy, which an enemy.
Wow.
Because under the 1911 Act, which was the old Official Secrets Act that they were prosecuted under, you have to prove that that entity is an enemy. So the hint from the government, they've never, you know, the prosecution service haven't explicitly explained it, but the strong hint is they couldn't prove.
And so is that contextually because, I mean, we're in a moment where the UK is having to figure out its foreign policy in relation to China, right? In between a China and US multipolar global order.
I mean, the way that the UK relates to China is so complicated.
The super embassy as well,
exactly. All of these. Some people are saying, you know, you should be much more aggressive and assertive. Other people say, no, well, you've got to deal with them because they're going to sell us the parts for wind farms, etc. Yeah. Anyway, they've updated the law. So in 2023, they brought in this new thing called the National Security Act, which I now oversee as well. I review it as a lawyer. So the law is in place. And, you know, if anything, the law goes pretty far and gives even more discretion to police and prosecutors than terrorism legislation, where at least there's some sort of element of violence, whereas including to property, but some element of violence. National Security Act, I mean, you can commit the offence of foreign interference reasonably easily. Let me put it that way. Yeah. I don't think you'd be prosecuted for it, but I mean, the conduct is quite broad. So that's the law. How do you implement the law? How do you actually make the law have any meaning? I mean, the law is just bits on a page, isn't it? You've actually got to have investigators. You've got to have police carrying out arrests. You've got to have evidence that you can use in court. And I really stress that point about evidence, because you may have all sorts of suspicions, but proving that someone is a secret spy for Russia or China,
it's really hard.
Yeah. Even if you, just proving the contact is not necessarily going to be very, very easy. So what people in government talk about is this concept of resilience. In a way, it's slight hogwash. It's quite hard to know what it really means. I think probably my best understanding of it is basically everyone's got to toughen up a bit and just be a bit sharper. And actually a bit more patriotic. So one of the groups of people who might find themselves caught up in state threat activity, as it's called, are private investigators.
Yes.
Okay. So let's say I'm Russia. I want to try and track down a dissident so I can go and kill them. I might well want to find out where they live and establish a pattern of life so that I can work out when to time my attack on them. I could well come up to a private investigator and say, look, I'm serving a writ on my ex-wife. I think she lives in this address. I'm not sure. Can you just tell me what she does on a day-to-day basis so I can then go and serve the papers, because it's got to be done personally, according to Russian law or whatever it is. You could spin that story and the private investigator can suddenly find themselves doing something for Russia. Now, whether they know or not, whether they ought to know, will determine whether or not they've committed a crime.
Right.
But, you can see how dodgy individuals could, or digital marketers, to bring it up to date. Someone says, let's do a sort of campaign. We really push the Iranian view. Why not? What's wrong? I'll pay you £1,000. Don't say that it's Iran. Make it look as if it comes from a local community organisation or something like that. Foreign interference. So I think what resilience in practice means, getting people who might be tempted to do things for those powers to toughen up and say no.
But I think the problem is that there's such a cash incentive for doing this stuff at the moment, right? Like, do you know Inevitable West, the account on Twitter, right?
Yes, it's Indian.
It's an Indian guy in Dubai who's making money off advertising on X, right?
Yeah.
Pretending to be a white nationalist, British Christian, right? So there is a cash incentive for peddling misinformation at the moment. And I think that confuses or perhaps exacerbates the ideological motivations for people to be trying to sow division or subversion in our politics. I wanted to just quote your speech from Policy Exchange, because I think you know, when you were talking about anti-subversion and countering these threats to democracy, I thought it was really powerful. If I were a foreign intelligence officer, of course I would meddle in separatism, whether Scottish independence or independence of overseas territories or Brexit. I would encourage extreme forms of environmentalism, hoping that policies generated would damage my adversary's economy or at least sow discord or hopelessness. If I were a foreign intelligence officer, of course I would ensure that the UK hated itself and its history, that the very definition of a woman should be put into question, that masculinity would be presented as toxic, that white people should be ashamed and non-white people aggrieved. I would promote anti-Semitism within politics. My intention would be to cause both immediate and long-term damage to the national security of the UK by exploiting the freedom and the openness of the UK by providing funds exploiting social media and entryism. Now, you touched upon loads of different flashpoints in the culture wars there.
Hot issues.
I think quite a few on our left side, on our left flank. You know, we're concerned about environmentalism, for instance, but we're aware that energy security is a problem. It's a massive tension. Mm-hmm. I think the point that I kind of want to draw out here is that there are our politics is dealing with multiple crises on multiple different fronts, places where people are polarised and really are, you know, one side is absolutely convinced about one course of action and the other is convinced about the inverse, right? And government is trying to negotiate these things whilst conducting some sort of free and open society.
Yeah.
And it just seems to me that we are just not equipped to deal with this.
I so agree. I mean, I've often said that I think that children should come off social media. I mean, we'll talk about the Online Safety Act, but you know, I don't think that that kids can deal with social media.
No.
Full stop.
I don't think adults either.
But the point I was going to make is I don't think we can either.
Yeah.
And I mean, just thinking about some of the policing response to the Graham Linehan tweets, for example, that if there's a trans person and call the police and if they don't leave, then punch them in the balls. Being arrested for that just seems to me completely absurd. But the police haven't worked out how to deal with that because to me, somewhere there's someone who's made a complaint and said that that's having a real impact on me, and the police haven't worked out how to deal with this. So I think the problem is, I almost hope that the whole of social media is just full of AI slop. And so when you see the inevitable West, you go, oh, well, it's just AI. I'm not going to believe it as well. I mean, we all know, don't we, that it's much better to have a conversation in person. I mean, I've had conversations in person in my sort of life with people who I violently disagree with, but you have a conversation. Mm-hmm. And if someone goes too far, whatever. Social media is not the way to conduct, but it's how we do conduct these conversations.
The problem we then have, though, is that trying to, you know, for the government to try and exercise some control, it just looks like a clampdown on free speech, right?
Or it looks like you're taking an ideological position.
You're saying that in my article, I'm sort of criticising excessive environmentalism.
Who's the arbiter?
Who is the arbiter?
Yeah. The truth is, I suppose I'm not completely stupid, but I thought I'd say that because it's quite get people going.
Yeah,
it's
provocative.
Get a bit of attention because I want to. And I mean, the way in which, if you were the Russian intelligence officer, of course, you could take both sides.
Mm. Yeah.
You could both promote extreme environmentalism and you could promote climate denial.
Yeah.
Because in a way, and I don't want to exaggerate how effective the Russians are, but it would be in their interest to do both.
Right.
Just effectively, you know, I could be a really pro-trans campaigner as a Russian to wind up the people who get really cross about it and vice versa.
And be so, really anti-trans as well.
Be really anti-trans as well, exactly, both sides. As to who's the arbiter, I mean, we ought to talk about sort of the free speech issue.
Mm.
Or do you want to go back to the politics thing?
No, go to the free speech and then
yeah,
the politics.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, the free speech thing, I think that we're all beginning to realise now, aren't we, that importing absolute free speech from the US is not the way to go. And the reason I say that is because even the Americans seem to be waking up to this. Yeah. After the killing of Charlie Kirk, people are now saying, well, what about this violent rhetoric on the left? And then you get these sort of weird overreactions like cancelling comedians and whatever. But they're asking questions which actually in the UK are fairly familiar to us. We do have laws that would stop you encouraging terrorism generally, right? In America, you don't get that.
No.
You only get speech which is encouraging immediate steps. So if I say, go and kill someone now, yes, that would be cool. If I say, you know, in the future, you might want to go and do something, including carrying out attacks on, you know, Jews and Muslims or whatever, that's completely fine in America. And I think the US are beginning to wake up to the fact that that is not desirable from any side. And both the left and the right, I think, are going through a sort of learning process now that it's worth having some limitations. I mean, I would say somewhere between certainly not Graham Linehan's tweets. I mean, that just seems totally bizarre. I mean, what Musk said, I think, you know, you may dislike it and condemn it, but I don't think you should be prosecuted for that. Then you get to Lucy Connolly. Of course, that was a crime. Of course it was. I mean, I find it baffling that she's put forward as a sort of free speech martyr. I guess I'm saying what you agree with, but I mean, I genuinely do. Yeah. And it's somewhere between those two extremes, isn't it? That we say we protect free speech very strongly.
But it's me speech versus free speech, isn't it? As Timothy Snyder put it, it's this idea that, you know, free speech for me, but not for thee, right? Like absolutism for my ideological positions, for things that agree with my worldview. But if you say something that threatens that, that needs to be cut off.
Yes.
And I think what we've seen in America with that pivot, right, from, you know, the J.D. Vances and whatever. And there's plenty of MAGA commentators who are also saying that this, you know, sullies Charlie Kirk's legacy, that Charlie Kirk would have, objected to this. And that's not to lionize Charlie Kirk, by the way. I think there's been some revisionism about who he was and what he represented and what he spoke about. But, you know, this idea that as soon as I'm in a position of power, you know, and I'm hearing things that I don't like and I think that threaten our worldview, now we can clamp down. And to be a cynical point of view, I would say that maybe this is fitting some of the political project for MAGA to have complete control over the terms of political discourse, right? You've got lawsuits against major independent media publications from, you know, the Wall Street Journal to, you know, ABC to all of these other American publications to the New York Times, $15 billion. Yeah, I mean, that's insane.
We recognise that from the UK and we, you know, we're not perfect on this. Obviously, we have what's called slap litigation where Russian oligarchs have tried to stop journalists from publishing things by threatening them with weird data protection suits or with libel. So it's familiar territory, but it's no better in America than it is here. I mean, I find it baffling.
But we are importing it, aren't we? I think because the digital ecosystem is so flat, right? Anyone can say anything from anywhere in the world and we all see it from our own perspective.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think that there's an economic aspect to this which you shouldn't be disregarded. And I mean, it goes into the question of AI as well. So quite a lot of the free speech debate is looking at the negative effects of AI. The economic point is we are not doing as well economically as a country as we would like to be. Ever since, I think, Rishi Sunak said this, we're going to be an AI sort of superpower. And with the Trump investment that's just come from the royal visit, there is a desire to have more of that. What this means is that the approach to free speech is going to have to be calibrated in a way that allows these businesses to grow and flourish. And of course, they are absolutely full of First Amendment rights, maybe because Elon Musk and others believe in it as a matter of principle, maybe because actually it makes it much easier for them because they don't have to moderate their content. So I did a big piece of work last year about how you would use the law to stop people importing terrorist chatbots. And one of the considerations that I very much had in mind was, if you start making people liable, like the people who are, I don't know, creating the large language models, which might at some stage be trained to become terrorists, if you said to them, well, you might commit a terrorist offence if what you create goes on to become a terrorist chatbot, then you would drive out that sort of investment. And obviously, I'm not an economist at all. That's not my role at all. But thinking about what laws you might want to have, you have to be mindful of the fact we, as a country, have invited an inward investment. But the net effect of that is that there'll be some caution, I would have thought, about clamping down, if you like, on free speech, as well as the principled reasons for against clamping down on free speech.
I think the terror, that specific aspect of regulation is a massive sticking point right now for this AI revolution that's happening. And I'm very concerned about the lack of thought that's being put into AI regulation, right? Not just from the perspective of like terror chatbots, but from this idea like generative AI, if people are allowed to just feed in whatever they want to feed into this thing, you know, most people don't have the ability to discern true, real from fake. And we have just put like hands off and just let the world, let people just kind of use that for what, from deep fake pornography to perhaps, you know, things that are going to incite violence or,
You're completely right. I mean, it's worth making the point that when people talk about absolute free speech, they do mean websites like letpeopledie.com sorts of things like that. That is what is protected by free speech in America. And I don't think we would want to protect it here. I mean, I think the honest answer is, I think it's game over on that. I mean, you know, I use Microsoft Word. It's now got Copilot added in. We all have WhatsApp. It's got this little sort of, I didn't ask for that AI thing. They are absolutely pushing AI at us all the time. I mean, when I speak to young people, I get told we use AI for like, how's my hair? Advice on my relations with my parents and things like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I you know, if I was, you know, the internet, online world with or without AI is just the frontier, and we have to do things about it. I mean, that's why I think I'm a bit sort of taken aback by the idea I've heard from Reform about repealing the Online Safety Act completely. I definitely get the points. There are some really excellent writers about it. There's Graham Smith, who's a solicitor, writes brilliantly about why the Online Safety Act is wrong in principle. And he has this phrase that speech is not a tripping hazard. You know, you can't make people liable for negligence in speech, because speech, the lifeblood of speech is your ability to say things. And you should only ever stop it if it's going to cause immediate harm, which is very hard to prove. So he has a principled reaction. I think, you know, I'm a follower of his. But I think simply repealing the Online Safety Act for me feels like importing the American way, and is just basically saying you've got to have an absolute approach. And what I quite like about the Online Safety Act is at least it allows us, whether or not it's going to be effective, whether Ofcom can regulate Kiwi Farms and 4chan and these US groups who are already challenging Ofcom, at least it's the UK saying, however imperfectly and subject to further debate, these are our standards. And that seems to me, you know, a good thing democratically, that the UK is trying to impose some standards.
And on the Online Safety Act in particular, the idea of the Online Safety Act is that people are getting exposed to things that they shouldn't be exposed to, yeah. Right? And I think anyone, when they hear substantively like what the purpose of that legislation is, which was originally Tory legislation, we just made sure it came into law. It's really hard to argue with it. And this is the thing that I think even Reform supporters themselves, when you poll them about what's substantively in the Online Safety Act, they're actually the most in support of it than about protecting children from, you know, harmful material than any other political party. But I think from Reform's side, as you rightly pointed out, what they're seeing is a threat to this Americanizing of our economy. This sense that, like, well, the only way in which we're going to get growth right now is just through flat out deregulation.
Yeah.
And the only place where there is growth is in AI and in tech. And ergo, what you must do then is have no regulation.
Yeah.
And that to me is putting capitalism, you know, just putting making money above all other considerations. And I don't think that that's how we have ever really thought to run our country.
That's where I kind of wonder whether in British politics more broadly there needs to be a new ideological landscape as to how we operate within this terrain. So outside of the kind of conceptions that we should just implement all of this infrastructure because it is kind of this nascent way of which we can propagate growth in our country, and then the kind of questions around civil liberties and free speech, it seems as though politics is so caught within the binaries of socialistic or social democratic thinking and kind of free market thinking, and then
I just think there's a lack of understanding of the online world. I mean, it drives me mad when I hear politicians say that the Online Safety Act makes illegal online what is illegal offline, and the answer is it doesn't at all. All it does is create a series of safety duties,
guardrails,
which will be implemented however perfectly or not. And whether or not those safety duties are ever implemented will depend upon the ability of Ofcom, which has got an enormous job, to bring enforcement action against some tech companies who simply don't want to be regulated at all. So it's not the case that it's creating a whole load of crimes. You know, on the other hand, as we said, just racing to total deregulation just doesn't seem to be, I mean, most people don't agree with it, I would have thought. On the civil liberties point, I mean, the terrorism side, which I'm obviously most interested in, and I'll come on to the national security side, the terrorism side, initially what the bill, the Online Safety Act said was you should simply remove terrorism content. And I said to the government at the time, well, that's a bit weird because content isn't itself terrorist. I mean, let's say I was to send you a picture and say, here is an outrage being committed in a war, all right? You might go, well, I'm, you know, Jonathan sent this to me. I'm really worried about this. That makes me think very differently about that combatant in the war And potentially, if you were a journalist, you might say, well, I'm going to investigate that. And potentially, if you're a lawyer, you might say, well, I'm going to sort of try and build some war crime case. So passing some information is very different. Whereas I could send it to you with a nudge, nudge, wink, wink, and saying, this is what we should be doing. So content itself is not terroristic. What is terroristic is the intent behind it. So the government did, in response to my intervention, change the legislation to require the tech companies to think, what's the state of mind behind the person who's doing it? So
by the person who's posting it.
By the person who's posting it, absolutely. Right, yeah. They haven't really worked out how to deal with bots yet, I should
say.
But exactly, because, I mean, that must be right. Otherwise, I would not be able to send you information because they just say, well, let's infer that everyone who's providing certain information, I mean, it could be, I don't know. I mean, let's say I'm a Muslim scholar and I am debating something perfectly valid about some, you know, whether you need Muslim states. You could take the view, if you're not thinking about what's in that person's mind, well, it's all terrorism, isn't it? And that would obviously be wrong. On the other hand, I think there is a, I mean, we haven't really got onto this, but I think it's almost worth saying, is, and I mean, this is a bit of a heresy in a way. Question one, what is the value of AI-generated content at all in terms of free speech? I can see some circumstances. I mean, let's say I've got learning difficulties and very hard to express myself, or maybe I don't speak the language that, well, I could use AI to express myself, like dealing with officials and things. I can see some value there. But basically, a lot of the AI slot that we have, I don't think has any merit. And it's quite hard to... The second question, more difficult question, where I'm really split on this, is what is the value of social media content? I mean, I find social media content really useful in my job. But I know that a lot of it is just total rubbish. And I do wonder whether or not looking at cat pictures or looking at pictures of, I mean, I'm sorry to say it, burning Jordanian pilots, which was the famous picture that came from Islamic State, which seems to radicalise quite a lot of people. They found it sort of, in a bizarre way, sexy.
Yeah.
What is the value of that? And I think that we talk about free speech, like conversation you might have now, or broadcasting, or journalists, but what we're really talking about is often a lot of rubbish.
I think the problem is that on the other side of the ledger, right, there's the democratization of information has made it such that the media, the independent media, aren't just the gatekeepers now of what people know is what's happening in the world. And, you know, most people would feel really uncomfortable about that being disrupted now, for instance, having been able to see,
I think you're right,
what's happened in Gaza, for instance, and been like, you know, in times gone by, Israel would have just put a complete blackout zone on what was going on.
We knew very little about what was going on.
Exactly. And now people can see the horrors directly themselves. I mean, I guess one of the problems that we're having to deal with is that there are places where social media is acting as this like open gate and everyone could see it. But then let's say in Myanmar, for instance, you know, it's not being...
China.
Exactly. So China's work in Myanmar, where they're playing both sides of the conflict, but still all of their interests are protected. No one's seeing that. There's no massive salience over that as an issue.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I mean, if you were China, you might say, well, let's have a big firewall. Let's make sure that TikTok only curates videos which encourage children to become doctors. And then let's have a algorithm that makes all the kids in America look at cats, and then hopefully a bit of extremism as well.
Yeah.
Because that's a way to win. I agree. I mean, I think that the ship has sailed. And I think that if you said to people now, you can't have access to social media at all, they would just say no, it's an expectation.
But also, I mean, if you look to the most recent revolutions that have happened, conducted by Gen Z, right, it was the social media blackout.
Well, this is it. I think the kind of experience in Nepal some weeks ago is a bit of a climax around this issue, where young people have utilised social media to their own ends and to a point of overthrowing the government and installed a new government.
Was that good or bad?
I mean, who's to say? I think it's still in its infancy, but we've seen a whole generation of people become politicized because of a government that was failing to respond to their needs. And this is, I think, what seems to be coming down the track. I mean, maybe not so much in exactly the same way, but where people are utilizing their sense of agency, which they've been able to see through social media and what life is like on the other side, as in the case of Nepal. And does our infrastructure, we've spoken about it, but can it really accommodate kind of a mass movement of people who want structural reformation of their state and how they live their lives? going into what is now a new century.
Yeah, and also just to really dig deep on that point, that it was the government's attempt to shut down social media. Yeah. Yeah. That was the death knell. That mobilized everyone, because they were like, hold on, they're taking away our means of information right now for Gen Z, right? Because Gen Z's life is social media. And I'm pretty sure it was similar in Kenya and in, mm-hmm. it was definitely similar in, what was the revolution? In Bangladesh. It was in Bangladesh as well. That was, again, another Gen Z-led revolution where they tried to shut down social media, tried to enforce a media blackout. And that legitimized the counter-governmental revolutionary process.
I understand that. And I don't know the answer at all. I mean, I think the point about people becoming more politicized is not necessarily negative. I mean, people talk about politicization as if it's basically extremism. But actually, if people understand what's going on in the world, can participate, are more alert to the issues of the day, that in principle is a good thing. And in a very minor way, we've lost all these local news stations. So we don't know what's happening in the courts because, you know, the local paper doesn't send a reporter to Westminster Magistrates Court to sit and look at every case, maybe pick up the fact that some politician's been done for driving. Social media is an amazing replacement for that and a good thing.
Yeah, and it's killed that off. I mean, on the revolutionary point, because I do think that that narrative even here is becoming more and more kind of prosecuted, right? Like, you've got David Betts, who's a KCL professor in the war studies department, going on podcasts with Trigonometry saying that, you know, civil war, you know, could be coming down the tracks here. It's almost inevitable and stuff like that.
Well, he's from a war department.
Yeah.
I guess he pretty well.
There is a gigantic ball of political energy that is building up. The spark is just intrinsically unpredictable. If we had to list factors in order, multiculturalism would be at the top. And if we were to put some kind of ranking on them, it's like 90%.
But do you know what I mean? That there is I'm not going to say it's going to be people are willing it on, but there is a real
concern. I know what you mean. I mean, I have the Telegraph app on my phone and, you know, you read that, you think, gosh, sometimes they're actually willing on some civil war. I know exactly what you mean. And then the Guardian itself. So, I mean, I suppose you would expect me to say this, having said what I said about national security and comms and people being able to get on with their lives. But I would be really, really cautious, A, about taking too much cognizance of what people are saying on social media, particularly because we don't know who's doing it.
Yeah.
But it does bring to a head the question, going back to the Unite the Kingdom rally, where all of these people felt enthused and felt as though their grievances should be heard. And then they assembled all on Whitehall and in Westminster. And that was primarily through social media and Tommy Robinson saying what he was saying in order to galvanise a sector of the population to demonstrate their frustration with the democratic decisions of the day.
But isn't that just the way that life is complicated? I mean, there's good and bad in, I'm not saying there's good and bad in Tommy Robinson specifically, but if he was the organiser and people as a result were able to express themselves, which they're entitled to do, then that seems to be a relatively good thing. It's just a shame it was Tommy Robinson at the head of the organisation.
Mm. So do you think that we are heading to something like, I don't know, like a new McCarthyism? Like, we're going to have to bring in some laws in place to protect democracy from itself in this wild west of information?
I don't think so. I think we're going to get more of the sort of blitz spirit. I think that's what people are going to be talking about. So resilience. I think we're going to go down the sort of Nordic model. So kids are going to have much more education about disinformation. Probably trained more in, you know, what to do in the event of a conflict or a war, how to deal with sabotage, what to look out for. And I think that politicians will start talking a lot more about that Second World War spirit of unity and togetherness, etc. I mean, the alternative, which will be pushed by China, is just to say, go total surveillance and have social credits. So if not only, you know, someone is acting as a dissident, but they're just crossing the road when there's a red light, then you lose social credits and you can't go on a plane. I mean, that's the model that China will be trying to. And if you think the democracies, I think the figure I heard recently is that of the world, 26% is democracy now. Mm-hmm. So I think we are having to protect ourselves. And if counter-subversion means protecting democracy, not a bad thing.
I mean, that is really Orwellian, isn't it? That the China stuff is. I mean, there's, I think the premium's really being paid right now on this idea of like security and safety and compliance, you know, this thing about almost about homogeneity in a way that things need to be, if everyone is the same, if there isn't diversity, if there isn't multiculturalism, if there isn't people with disparate ends and goals, etc., then you can have a well-functioning society. But no one's talking about the other side of that argument, which is you don't have the freedom to criticize your government and think for yourself.
I mean, if you've ever been to, I mean, I went to Syria before the civil war, but even then it was under Assad. Leaving a repressive state for a democracy is an amazing feeling. Mm. And that sort of sense of, right, I can cheer, I can say things. It's really profound. And I mean, I'd be terrified if we went down that particular model.
I mean, does it alarm you that that narrative's becoming a bit more popular, this idea that, you know, multiculturalism cannot work?
Yeah, you know? Yeah, it does. It does bother me. It does bother me. And I mean, because we know where it goes. China found a population of people called the Uyghurs. Mm. And there are Uyghur terrorists. But they said, let's have the whole population and let's get rid of them by putting them in camps, etc. That's where that goes. So, of course, I'd be worried about that.
But there's not a sense of trying to put the brakes on any of that stuff. I think some people think it's politically expedient to use those narratives about, you know, a country that is at war with itself, that there's an enemy within.
Yes, yes. Well, it goes back to your point about communication, doesn't it? I mean, I think that we need politicians and, you know, sometimes they rise to the challenge. But I think making that point that we're not anywhere near a civil war. We're not going to be China, but I think a bit of resilience, yeah.
And do you worry that there's a sense, if you look at the kind of global picture, that where we're heading towards is probably some form of global conflict, that America's struggling with itself, that there is clearly
a trade war. I'm not
a foreign policy expert. I mean, obviously, I think about catastrophes because that's my job. So, I mean, I do think about what use hot war could make about AI. I obviously think about sort of disasters in democracy, like what happens if you had a deep fake of a leading political candidate doing something appalling with an animal or, you know, receiving a bribe. How would you deal with that if you had a lot of attacks? I mean, one of the things actually, I mean, no one, maybe this seems counterintuitive, but with the National Security Act and the absolutely objective requirement to look at the role played by Russia, China and Iran, it does put some people who've got a Russian, Iranian, Chinese background on the back foot quite a lot. And of course, one of the things that you hope counterterrorism has moved beyond is any impression.
Profiling.
Exactly.
But on the Russia stuff, Russia and US, I mean, I know you're not a foreign policy expert, but I imagine you're well aware that there's been a real change in that relationship, right, between Russia and the States, this sense of, you know, I saw it as they were trying to force some sort of decoupling between China and Russia. Now the tone's changed in the context of the Ukraine war and Trump saying, you know, stop buying Russian oil, India, stop buying Russian oil, you know, Germany and parts of Europe. But there's no sense in that conflicts are going to end, and there's a definite shift in position from the previous administration, right?
Yeah, I mean, personally, I'd love to talk to you about this, but it's just so far outside my competence.
Okay, right, yeah. You're right. We'll stay on terrorism.
Although, I mean, I should say I was sanctioned by Russia 3 weeks ago.
Congratulations. Oh.
So, yeah, Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
Wow. So that's a badge of honour.
Apparently.
Yeah. Why did they do that?
Because me, along with a journalist, a police officer and various charity heads have been involved in disinformation against Russia, apparently. So I'm banned from travelling.
Is that because you were calling out those, you know, Russian operating Bulgarian assets in the UK and stuff like that?
I don't know. I don't know whether it's a policy exchange speech where I talked about if I was a Russian intelligence officer. I don't know. I mean, the reality is I've spoken, I suppose the way in which I try and do my job is because I've got a sort of simple brain. I can only really explain things if I can sort of visualise it. And so I will often talk about things in the context of Russia. Maybe they've taken umbrance at that. I don't know.
The final thing I want to talk to you about is a little bit about how actually well the government's doing on countering terrorism. And people might not be aware of this, but the story really is, if you've been paying attention, is that the government's foiled a number of serious plots over the years. And whilst perhaps in this space of like ideology, extremism, radicalization, lots of questions, especially around free speech, but in the actual people organizing to commit acts of terror, we're doing a good job.
Yeah. We are. And some of it is definitely because we have this sort of quite envied relationship between MI5 and the police. So if you look at other states, you'll have your intelligence services who'll be dealing with high-grade intelligence, sometimes from foreign partners, and they will hold it very, very tight, and they won't hand it over to the people who can actually carry out the arrests. The UK has an amazingly integrated system. So the way in which MI5 and the police operate together is pretty hand in glove. They do trust one another a lot. And the particular part of it, I deal with them a lot, is the counterterrorism police. And they are world leading. There's no sort of ego involved. They're very good at what they call disrupting things. So one of the things that you can look at the stats, how many attacks have there been, how many arrests, etc. But there are other ways of dealing with terrorism. You know, it could be I could arrest a terrorist for theft. And that might just be enough to think, well, actually, you know, the police are onto me now. I might be able to use prevent. I might be able to simply knock on the door. I might be able to speak to someone else who can speak to someone else. There's lots of methods. And the police have seen this very good. The number of attacks. Well, we had that appalling high point in 2017, right? Yeah. Manchester, London, etc. That correlated with Islamic State. Mm. And Islamic State was weird because it wasn't really predicted. It was both a sort of sucking people in, but also a massive inspiration to people in the UK. We've tailed down from that. I think what the police have is the advantage of the internet, because that will allow them, with whatever intelligence work they're doing, to work out people are being pulled into it. On the other hand, the disadvantage is there's the internet. If you look at the most recent attacks, there were two attacks. There was an attack by some man who thought that the police were responsible for immigration, stabbed a female police officer, if I'm right, in the leg in a really dangerous area. And the one before that was a neo-Nazi who went to somewhere called the Pear Tree Hotel in Worcester. Some migrant had gone back for his iPhone, as far as I can work out, and he like went up to him, "You migrant," stabbed him in the neck, almost killed him. That particularly that one was very internet driven. So I mean, the problem about the internet is it might give you clues.
Like the internet's stopping organisations, but these like lone actors.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. That is crazy. I mean, the prison stuff, you brought it up then. I mean, Shabana Mahmood, the new Home Secretary, the briefing is that she got promoted because she did a good job. And Javan's a fan.
I think she's very good. I think she's very capable.
Yeah.
And she seems to be... I don't know. She seems to have an understanding between what the role of the executive should be doing and the legislature in order to address the issues of the day, or at least they're sympathetic to some of my political thoughts anyway.
Yes, I mean, for what it's worth, I thought that she was right on what she did. I mean, it's in the weeds, but there was a whole issue over the Sentencing Council. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, this is very much in the weeds, but yes, I see what you mean. Anyway, I'm about to meet her, so I'll reserve my position.
I'm also from Birmingham, so...
Brummy solidarity.
Yeah, exactly.
But the reason I bring her up is that obviously, so she was looking at the crisis in the prison system that we inherited. I mean, you kind of are in the CT world, counterterrorism world, looking at what's happening in those jails. I imagine you're quite worried about understaffing, about full jails, about...
I'm extremely worried. I mean, the message that I got was, because I go to speak to a lot of people about this, is that not just the amount of violence, but the amount of really serious violence is just sort of...
In prisons.
It's gone up, yeah. I mean, it seemed to start after the Chris Grayling reforms. So a lot of long-standing prison officers left. They brought in fewer and a lot of very new and inexperienced staff. And if you think about it, when you're dealing with a difficult criminal in a Category A prison, they're not necessarily stupid.
No.
And they're manipulative. And if you're some 23-year-old sociology graduate who's just come out of university, it's not going to be easy. And you've got to have the ability to stand up and say to someone, in my world, what I found is that Islamist terrorism is the biggest threat in prisons. And you might get someone who's a former who is a terrorist prisoner, saying to the prison imam, you get away. I'm going to be one standing in front of everyone on Friday prayers. And then exercising influence over other people who will then start to go, well, actually, yeah, I quite like what he did. Let's do something similar, either in prison or on release. Having the ability as a prison officer to go up to that one and say, I'm afraid I'm not letting you do that. The prison imam's going to do it. Facing maybe allegations of racism or Islamophobia, or you just don't get it or whatever, or intimidation, just simple, crude intimidation, is really hard. So the loss of experienced prison officers, some of whom had a military background, some of whom had a police background, was a real problem. But also what I'm hearing is that the people are more willing to use more serious violence now. So even if there was some sort of code that you wouldn't necessarily stab someone, but you might use some other sort of violence, now people are willing to go for the max earlier on. So generally I'm worried. And obviously my particular interest is CT and the ability of terrorist prisoners potentially to use weapons to attack staff.
So recently you've been looking at a case in a prison, yes, of a former terrorist convicted terrorist attacking a police officer. What happened there?
A prison officer.
Yeah.
So this is Hashim Abedi, who has been convicted, serving life with a minimum of 55 years.
Right.
For his role in the Manchester Arena attack.
He was the brother of
the brother of Salman Abedi. Well, he was an attacker, but he wasn't, you know, he organised the logistics, the making of the bomb, the planning of it. He was over in Libya when his brother blew himself up and killed all those people. He was then extradited to the UK and prosecuted. He goes to prison. Whilst he's in prison, he carries out an attack in Belmarsh. And then he's moved to this special unit called a separation centre because they're worried about the influence he might have on other prisoners. And whilst he's there, he throws hot butter over officers, and he, with an adapted, a homemade weapon, he stabs one of the prison officers in the neck, almost kills them. I should say, this is the allegation. He's got a criminal trial going forward, but the facts are that he came out and attacked, almost killed one of them. I think he's charged with attempting to murder three of them. But it was a very serious attack, very, very serious attack. So I was asked to report about how you deal with the most prisoners who are not only influential, but violent. So I went to see the Supermax prison in America, Florence, Colorado, and looked to what we could do. And I made various recommendations. I mean, we'll see what the government makes of them.
Yeah, but on those Supermax prisons, I mean, even the US, who locks up their population more than anywhere else in the world, is looking to El Salvador with no respect for human rights as a way of controlling and deterring crime. I mean, look, I understand, you know, a friend said to me the other day, and this is not like an anti-democratic, very well-educated friend, but he was like, ultimately, people want to feel safe, right? So like, you know, you might be disrespecting human rights, or this is in favour, I guess, of what Nayib Bukele's done, but he's locked up all of these violent criminals, and now people can go out and walk out on the streets. And I think that there is a sense that people are seeing a lot of disorder and chaos in their personal lives, maybe petty crime, less so than violent crime. I think actually the violent crime's down in the UK.
Yes, it's all online now.
But But I guess everyone has this impression that it's gone up because they're seeing more of it, seeing more broken windows, etc. But that's kind of creating, I guess, some sort of popular consent or growing consent for these
more aggressive
human rights criminals.
Well, there are I think there are two points there, aren't there? There's the question of how many people you lock up. So do you take a broken window approach and say you commit some minor infraction in, you go to prison? So general criminal law, that's not my bag at all in terms of that's not what I'm reviewing.
Yeah,
I look at terrorism legislation, not that. But that's one. But the second question, which I am looking at, is what are the conditions when you get into prison? And the Americans will say, I've got one mission, public safety. And if this guy has to sit buried in concrete for 20 years, fine. That is one approach you can take, isn't it? It's quite expensive.
Very expensive.
It does have quite an impact on people in the sense that, I mean, what I saw was that people, once they've been in the harshest conditions, they can't really leave. And they can't really associate with other people. So I think, you know, however you feel about these individuals, it is very, very harsh. It's also very, very expensive. And it requires, you know, we don't have the money here. And we probably hope, don't have the inclination just to sort of throw away the
key. Often the framing you hear is a concern between Islamist terrorism versus far-right terrorism. And I think there's a belief, you know, at least from different people's politics, that if you're going to focus on one, you need to also be equally focusing on the other. And William Shawcross's independent review of Prevent said that actually you need to focus more on the Islamist side because it's more complex and more difficult to challenge. But what I'm seeing more of in recent years, and especially in the news, is far-right terrorism or the threat of far-right activists who want to, you know, attack people or undermine democracy. Like, you've got people like the Homeland Party, right, who are cosplaying as a political entity, but, I mean, have all the hallmarks of being a radical extremist, you know, almost terror-willing organisation. Do you think that the threat actually is pretty equal at the moment between the far-right and the Islamists?
No. No, the threat is higher from the Islamist extremist men. So the casework of counterterrorism police is roughly three quarters Islamist extremist and a quarter extreme right wing. I mean, you know, there's one of the problems actually is there's no statistics that have published this. So you can look at the stats on who's arrested for terrorism offences, but it doesn't tell you what flavour. And one of the things I'm trying to push the government into is to say, you know, set that out.
Give the information. Because then you get people like me not having that impression.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, should you spend equal time? Of course not. You should spend the most time on the threat. And as Islamist extremist terrorism, if it does, goes down, don't spend so much time on it.
Well, I was just going to say, with growing kind of discord around multiculturalism or things around that, is it possible that we could be entering a world where far-right threat is potentially more considered than Islamist threat? Or does kind of global affairs dictate that there's still some parity? Or
I mean, it is really interesting. If you look at the global statistics, Islamist extremist terrorist groups are responsible for by far the largest number of worldwide deaths, measured in the tens of thousands around the world. You know, Al-Qaeda, Islamic State, KP, JNIM, Boko Haram. I mean, it is astonishing, actually, just how many terrorist deaths are caused by Islamist extremist groups. No other type of group, nationalist, extreme right wing, whatever, comes near to that. So I think if you're a security expert, you'll be looking at the world and you'll be saying, is any of that coming here? And that could be people who've travelled out from here to join a terrorist organisation, like used to happen with Al-Qaeda quite a lot, happened in Islamic State, Jihadi John, etc. And you're also looking at what they call external attack planning operations. So groups who might have an ambition not just to concentrate on their own particular terrain. I mean, you know, you might say the Taliban are more likely to focus on Afghanistan than anything else because they're in government. But then you might have some terrorist organizations. I mean, Al-Qaeda was the classic example, who have external aspirations to just to bring about damage in the West. And it doesn't surprise me if you look at the number of really dangerous Islamist extremist terrorist groups, that is still the number one threat. And I think until that goes, I don't think it's going to change, but I might be wrong.
Why do you think there is such confusion about that? Because I think a lot of people don't know that or think that it's the other way around, as I did.
I don't know. I mean, to some extent, it's helpful in a way. So before I did the job, there was a very strong narrative that terrorism laws were just anti-Muslim. And I do think that there has been a natural and understandable desire by the authorities to emphasise that terrorism is, what they say, threat neutral, and therefore to emphasise those cases which have come to light. I think also the internet thing makes them quite sort of visual. So if you've ever seen, I mean, you might see an Islamist terrorist attacker, they might have loads of screeds of Arabic views justifying attacks. But if you look at some extreme right-wing guy, he's probably got a picture of Saint Brenton Tarrant, a picture of a gun. I mean, you know, it's sort of visually quite striking. And also, I think it's also the fact, the presence of children. I mean, we look at these, you know, what gets on the news. I would have thought a 14-year-old planning to attack a mosque and a synagogue is going to cut through in a way that yet another Islamist extremist plotting to do something or encouraging attacks on kafirs is probably not. So it may just be a news thing.
I think there's also just a concern as well, isn't there, about people worrying that all Muslims are painted with the same brush as these specifically, you know, extremist people, right? And that then maybe leads to an overcompensating factor of, you know, not then addressing the actual extremists themselves.
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, you know, I think that the more you understand about the world, the more you can deal with people, and as you ought to, as individuals. I mean, the fear with terrorism legislation and with national security legislation is that you'll start thinking, well, that one, that group is basically an enemy or unpatriotic or whatever. Exactly. And the skill, and it's always going to be difficult for counterterrorism officers. I see how they work at ports and borders. Who do they stop? Do they stop this one? Do they stop that one? Oh, that person looks as if they could be Southeast Asian and they are coming from a well-known route to Afghanistan. Making that decision and trying to explain, I'm not doing that because of your group, because the threat, is always going to be quite difficult.
Yeah. And there's also been just like some common sense mistakes that people have done within Prevent, you know, like referring a child who said something innocuous, but then under the guise that they were, you know, radicalised.
It's bound to happen.
Yeah. And that's just part and parcel, is it? Yeah.
I'm afraid so.
Yeah. Look, Jonathan, that has been one of the most interesting conversations we've ever had. Yeah,
flummoxed by the whole thing.
I've just been left kind of speechless pretty much.
I shouldn't say
the time.
So am I, quite often.
I mean, is there as a parting kind of comment, cause for hope? Anything that makes you feel optimistic about the future?
Well, I think that we talk about it here. I mean, just thinking from the counterterrorism point of view, the media is really good. If you go to Ireland, Northern Ireland, the only thing they want to talk about is flags. They're not really interested. There's, you know, Southern Ireland doesn't really have that sort of media. Here, not only do you have a lot of people talking about these issues, but you have really sophisticated correspondents. I mean, the Home Affairs correspondents, security correspondents are really, really impressive. And I trust them enormously. So I think what gives me hope is that question of the message, which is important. I do think we have some strength in this country about delivering the message from trusted people.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Jonathan Hall, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.